Hi there, everybody. Welcome to a special tribute episode of Hugo's There podcast. We had unfortunate news in the last week that Werner Vinge has passed away, and so I got a ping from a friend asking if I was going to be doing any kind of tribute episode, and I thought that sounds like a great idea. And so kind of worked on who should be a guest on this, you know, who do I know that that might want to comment on that, and reached out to a few people, got a couple suggestions, and I've assembled a panel here of three folks that people will already know from listening to the podcast, and one newcomer, Rich Horton. Hi there, Rich.
Hi.
Why don't you introduce yourself briefly?
Okay. As noted, my name's Rich Horton. If you have heard of me, it's probably from my 20 years as a short fiction columnist for Locus. I also did a series of Best of the Year anthologies that ended a couple years ago due to COVID, basically, more or less. And I'm still working on occasional anthologies, and I write a whole lot of stuff for Blackgate and for my own blog, Strange at Ecbatan.
Awesome. And the person who suggested reaching out to Rich was Olav Rockne. Hi there, Olav.
Yeah. Hi, Seth. It's good to see you again. It's been a while. Yeah.
It has been a while, and this was your idea, really. You were the one who reached out and said, hey, if you're going to do anything, count me in. And I thought, well, that's a great idea. And you suggested Rich as well. So that was great. Thanks for doing that. And then we also have Trish Mattson. Hi, Trish.
Hey, Trish Mattson. I'm a longtime journalist, currently a freelance editor in science fiction fandom. I probably am most active on the Skiffy and Fanti show, and I edit reviews for their blog, and I write some reviews myself. I also have guested on several other podcasts, and I am the co-host of an intermediate Stargate One, Stargate Fun podcast, where we talk about the old episodes with a current perspective.
Nice. And I should mention that Olav was on the podcast for A Deepness in the Sky, and then for A Fire Upon the Deep, we had Russ Newcomer. Hi there, Russ.
Hey, Seth. Yeah, I'm just a random character that gets written in to move the plot forward and then out after about five pages.
Okay, perfect. So like I was talking about before we started recording, my experience with Werner Vinge is just having read his novels for the Hugos. I had never had any previous experience with him other than I had a friend at work who kept bugging me to read the Zones of Thought novels. And so he was very pleased when I eventually got to them. But what I want to do for this is just kind of facilitate conversation. I know that Werner Vinge's work is important to a lot of folks, and that's why we're doing this. And so I'll just sort of hand off to each of you, and we can start a conversation about anything, about the novels, about the man. I know that, Rich, you recently posted a obituary for Werner Vinge just, less than a day ago, I believe, as we're recording this?
Yeah, late yesterday.
Nice. So maybe you want to kick it off and talk a bit about Werner Vinge, maybe for people who don't know him or his work very well?
Okay. Werner was had a significant day job as a mathematician and computer scientist at, I think, originally University of California, La Jolla, and by the end at San Diego State. And he's curiously very famous for an idea in a paper he wrote for NASA, actually, on his concept of the technological singularity. He wrote this paper in 1993, and he said that 30 years from now, computers will be smarter than humans and self-aware, and the human era will be on the verge of being over. That deadline has been missed, although maybe he is has ascended.
It's been missed, at least in this zone, right?
In this zone, right, exactly. So I actually started reading him, his very first story, Apartness. I didn't read it when it first came out, but I read it in the Wolheim Carr Best of the Year volume for 1966, although it was a little bit later when I read it. It's a striking story, taking a very ironic look at apartheid and the let's just say the just fate of the apartheid regime in South Africa. And went on to read him occasionally as years went by when he appeared in Analog, but he became much more prominently known when he published a story called True Names, which was in a way the progenitor of the cyberpunk genre. It kind of invented cyberspace as a concept for people to go into and explore. And it was a very well done story too. And after that, I, along with everyone, began paying very close attention to his work. And he's most famous since then for his, what I think are his greatest achievements, is his Zones of Thought stories, set in a universe where near the center of the galaxy, there is no intelligence. In our area of the galaxy called the Slow Zone, normal human intelligence is possible, but no FDL travel, no anti-gravity, all kinds of stuff like that. In the beyond, towards the edges of the galaxy, much greater intelligence is possible, and that facilitates things like FTL travel. And then outside the galaxy, in what's called the Transcend, there's superhuman type intelligence that live very fast, very short lives, but really can do incredible things for good and ill. He wrote a number of other very good stories. He won, what, 3 Hugos for his novels, A Fire Upon the Deep and The Deepness in the Sky, which are the two first Zones of Thought novels, and then Rainbow's End. And a couple of Hugos for his novella, for short fiction, too, a couple of novellas. I really think he's an outstanding writer, and though very well known, in a way, perhaps underrated, or so it appeared to me when I surveyed his work just this week on the occasion of his passing.
It strikes me that, I mean, he's remarkably, what's the opposite of prolific? I don't know what the word for that is, but yeah. He is not a prolific author. For somebody right. who has enjoyed that much success, you know, depending on how you count it, it's about 20 short works and, what, 7 or 8 novels?
Eight novels and 20 short works, that maybe a few more, counting he wrote some short shorts towards the end of his career for Nature magazine. But yeah, and if you think about it, 5 Hugos out of that many works is probably about as high a ratio
as you can have. Amazing. Yeah.
1 out of 6 of his works won a Hugo, and he had 9 total Hugo nominations. I guess the term isn't nominations, but you know what I mean. He was on the ballot.
Yeah.
He was on the short list on 9 occasions. And that's really remarkable. And I think one thing we have to mention is that he's part of the only husband and wife duo who have each independently and separately won a prose fiction Hugo. Mm-hmm. And that his wife from 1972 to 1979 was Joan Vinge, who won for The Summer Queen in 1979. Snow Queen. Snow Queen. Yeah. Right, Summer Queen. She got a nomination for The Summer Queen.
And for all that, I think the best of her novels, I'm very unusual in saying that, is the one in between The Summer Queen and The Snow Queen, World's End, which I love. Some people are very disappointed by it, but...
You know, in about 99, 2000, she actually started working on a sequel to A Deepness in the Sky as one of her own novels, with the express permission of Werner. It was just before she got ill, so it never actually came to fruition. But I would have loved to have read that.
Yeah, I did not know that. That is... That would have been really cool. It turns out, though it's not necessarily that easy to see the connection, that her early Heaven's Reach novels, I think,
Outcast of Heaven's Belt.
Yeah, are explicitly intended to be set in the nearer history of the Zones of Thought. Totally set within the Slow Zone where we are, but kind of at the beginning of humanity beginning to expand, where eventually they bump up against the border between the Slow Zone and the beyond. But, so that would have been really, I did not know that, it would have been quite wonderful to see that novel. And her illness is one of the real tragedies in the life of a working author. She's written some since then, but never got back to full speed, as far as I can tell.
Yeah. Was her most recent novel the novelization of Cowboys versus Aliens?
That's the most recent one I know. Yeah. She wrote one other pendant, sort of pendant to the Summer Queen, Snow Queen books called Tangled Up in Blue, but you know, has not been able to write as much as I'm sure she hoped to.
Yeah.
Yeah, and Rich and Olav, talking about your point about Vinji's hit rate, his first published story was in 1965 when he was 21 years old, and his last book, 2011, he would have been 68, I think, or so. So that's a, you know, almost 50-year writing career that, you're right, he's not prolific, but he really packs a lot of quality into that period of time, which to me is really impressive that he's not a professional full-time author except until the very end of his career, and he still comes up with a lot of great short fiction and some really great novels in his output too.
Yeah.
Over that long period of time.
You know, thinking on the fly here a little bit, I have done episodes where we've done author deep dives, and I do kind of want to make this almost an informal one of those where I want to hear from folks on this podcast about, you know, where should someone start with Werner Vinge? What's, you know, what are the good short fiction titles to check out? I mean, it's also one of those things where there's so few of them, you could easily cover his entire bibliography. Trish, do you have any thoughts? Not
sure.
Necessarily on that, but, you know, anything you want to talk about Vinge?
Well, just to start off with, I'll note that although a lot of his work is very cerebral with amazing exploration of ideas, he also is one of the authors that has hit me with the hardest gut punch ever. I read Deepness in the Sky and Fire Upon the Deep right next to each other, like 20 years ago, so I'm afraid they've become tangled in my mind and I don't remember which one this happened in. But there's a woman who realizes that something is going on and she decides to do about it, and she is working on resistance and she gets caught. And it's like, oh no, she's going to get killed or something. And then they just casually say, okay, time to mind wipe her and reset her again. And I let out this strangled scream of realization. You know, not only have they been watching her all this time, not only, you know, is she stopped, but they've been doing this to her over and over again and manipulating her. And oh my God, that was just an amazing emotional blow. And so, yeah, he's a writer of great ideas, but he also really knows how to tell a story and get to you.
Yeah.
Yeah. That episode was part of Deepness in the Sky, and I think that is his best novel. And I think you may have mentioned this as well, Olav, that novel is absolutely stuffed with sense of wonder. I mean, and in so many different ways. And part of it is, you know, what happens to the woman, and I'm sorry that I've forgotten her name, which is terrible, but in The Deepness in the Sky, but that is a cool and incredibly scary science fictional idea that is that part of the book. But the book has so much more in it. It's got the scenes with the spider-like aliens on their home planet are amazing. And then the revelation at the end is just...
Spoiler, do you mind if we spoil that? Because I just think it's such a brilliant thought that Trixia Bonsall has been doing all of this translation and has humanized it.
Yes.
So the fact that these aliens have been anthropomorphized so much in the text, and the fact that part of her translation is actually the first lines of the spider story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I came to Werner Vinge is probably the reason that my blog exists, because in the 90s, I'd started to think that science fiction had grown stale and I'd grown away from it. I thought all of the ideas were already told in the, you know, decades ago. And a friend of mine named Tim Hills dragged me out to a Worldcon in Chicago. And I decided, okay, if I'm going to do this, if I'm going to, you know, vote on the Hugos, if I'm going to do a Worldcon, I'm going to read all of the nominees. And A Deepness in the Sky was, of course, a nominee at that for the best novel that year. And it just blew my mind. It was like, this is so filled to the brim with creativity and cleverness and things I've never seen in sci-fi before.
Yeah.
And it's yet readable and fun and cool. And I actually went back and read a bunch of previous Vinci and went, oh, I've read this before. And I hadn't even realized, I hadn't put two and two together that the Peace War, Marooned in Real Time, that these were the same guy. Because I'd liked those books well enough when I'd read them in the 80s or early 90s. But Deepness in the Sky was just, it was next level.
Yeah, it really was. I remember discussing that on the old Usenet news group, recarts.sfwritten, and which was truly a wonderful place to talk about science fiction in a text form back in the early days of the internet, I guess. And Patrick Nielsen Hayden, the editor at Tor, who is Werner's editor, had a phrase, something like, you know, full-throated scientifictional prose. I don't remember exactly, but pointing out that by that time, and he definitely improved as a writer over his career, by that time, he was not just a creator of really neat ideas, not just a creator of pretty good, pretty fun plots, but a true, very accomplished writer of prose and structure of his novels, thinking through all the implications is another thing he does all the time, which happened very much in A Deepness in the Sky. And I think that's what took him so long to write novels. He thought through everything and just didn't just brush over stuff, tried to think through all the implications and how they would affect us. And it was astonishing.
He also gave us memorable characters. Like I just think of, you know, Robert Koo in Rainbow's End.
Rainbow's End.
And Willy Washenden in The Peace War, who's actually based very closely on a historical figure, I think. He's really supposed to be a stand-in for Srinivasa Ramanujan, Indian mathematician. Mm-hmm. And Paul Hoeler, I don't know how to say the name. Again, the elderly mathematician and based on another historical figure. And Thomas Now, Ritzer Bruegel, all of the spiders, you know, Honored Purdue, that awful religious fanatic, and Trixia Bonsall. Like the fact that these names stick in your head and you can even think, you even have a sense of who they are years after reading these books.
Yeah. And even minor characters like Lazy Larry in The Blabber. It's just a relatively minor character, but amusing and seems like a real person. Known people with that sort of attitude, and I'm sure Werner did too. That's probably where he got it from. Yeah, I take it the older mathematician in The Peace War was based on Hardy was his name, right? The English mathematician who is Ramanujan's mentor in a sense. Although Hardy would say that he couldn't mentor him. He wasn't able to keep up with him.
Well, he helped guide him through the English system at least.
You know, Olav, you were saying how in the 90s you felt like SF was getting kind of staid and old. And I was really thinking of Vinci really as this transitional author between what I can't immediately come up with a better thing to say than like analog science fiction, not the magazine, but non-computer centric science fiction that you had in the 60s, 70s, and 80s. And then Vinci with True Names really... that is the only science fiction story that I can think of that has basically a Festschrift dedicated to it. There's a work that Vinci published that, you know, has essays from important figures in computer science and AI that are all talking about ideas they had that were kind of around a science fiction short story. And you see him move from kind of this early adventure-y science fiction to the real time where he's thinking about these really big ideas, and then Fire Up on the Deep, Deepness in the Sky. Those are truly computation and computers are central to those stories. And I really think he is like this transitional stage author of moving from these analog, you know, maybe a lot more physics and, you know, Foundation talks all the time about atomics that we never see happening to the modern, you know, cyberpunk, modern computer-centric computational stories. And I really think that Vinji does a lot to move the genre along in that time, in the 90s and early 2000s.
And let me just hop in quickly. Of course, lots of stories and books had computers in them before then, and sometimes even so far as to, you know, take over the world or run a war or whatever. But I think, yeah, you're right, that Vinji started moving it in the direction of computers aren't just tools that make things faster. They are actually transformational of society and how people interact with each other and with groups.
And it's interesting that this is part of his work right from the start. I mean, Apartness was his first published story, but it was, I think, the third one he wrote that got published. The first one he wrote, he was actually a senior in high school in 1962 when he wrote Bookworm Run. And it is about the computer and its ability to transform society and man's thinking. You know, there's almost something McLuhan-ish about his thesis that, you know, computers are tools and the tools we have transform us.
Mm-hmm. And even, you know, an idea like the singularity, which is a profoundly influential idea, even if he's not right. And my personal opinion is that we are not going to hit a singularity like he predicted anytime soon, maybe just because we're in the slow zone. But even so, and it's true with almost any scientist, that influence isn't just based on getting things right. It's based on thinking about things and making other people think about things, which is what an idea like the singularity did. It's what a story like Two Names did. It made people think about the kind of concepts, cyberspace and so on, that he examined in that.
And so I spent a bit of time digging around in the usual repositories of academic publishing, and I was surprised again at how little Vinji had published there. Mm-hmm. You know, he's got really not a lot of research published. His focus as a mathematician seems to have been topology and you know, functions in EP spaces. But outside of that, he was mostly a big ideas thinker.
Right.
And just to go on a digression about topology, again, his academic career is influencing his writing, because when you think about the zones of thought, that is entirely a space-time topology speculation.
Yeah.
Yeah, it did make me think a little bit of Poole Anderson's book Brainwave, in which people started getting smarter and they realized that they had moved out from a zone of space where somehow thought waves were suppressed, and that they were moving into a zone of space where brainwaves were not suppressed. And then the animals started getting smarter, and that caused some problems. You know, if rats get smart and stuff like that. But then finding out that, you know, there are other life forms out in space, but they had competed with the smarter, with the freer brains, and that the effect of that was that they hadn't had to compete as hard. And so the now suddenly super smart humans were leaps and bounds ahead of even those out in the smart zones. So that was an interesting thing. You know, so the idea of zones of thought, yeah, I don't know if he came up with it on his own or if he had read Poole Anderson years before or whatever, but the way that he took the idea and ran with it with some really, really fascinating books, and not just, obviously, not just zones of thoughts, but so many fascinating ideas that he had, is just amazing.
I'm morally certain that I know he was fond of Paul Anderson's writing, so I'm sure he read that novel.
Okay.
But he said he had an interesting introduction to The Blabber, which was the first Zones of Thought story published. There we go. And he discusses that, and essentially he was trying to find a way to write stories in which he didn't have to worry about the singularity that he was convinced was going to happen. And I think he was sincerely convinced, and he would probably admit that when he said it would happen in 30 years, that was just a number, and it could be 50, it could be 100, but it would happen. And so for writing science fiction 1,000 years or 10,000, however far in the future the Zones of Thought books are, that was a trick to get around that problem, but it was a really fruitful trick. And as he did, he thought through the implications, and he came up with all kinds of really intriguing ramifications of that. And it's interesting, and I think important for storytelling purposes, that all his Zones of Thought stories are set approximately on the border between the slow zone and the beyond. Hmm. Because that gives you that conflict and the the story engine, in effect, having, you know, the blabber is all, and one of the reasons that makes the blabber so moving is this idea of being trapped in the slow zone, knowing that there's something really wonderful outside of it, in that particular story, 9 light years away, that is essentially all but unreachable. And that in itself is a very powerful idea.
I thought that deepness in the sky was on the border of the slow zone and the unthinking depths.
I think you're right, but there's... Yes, yeah, and remember, you know, Joe Walton pointed out that if you haven't read A Fire Upon the Deep, you don't necessarily know the fate of Pham Nguyen Win at the end of Deepness in the Sky is really powerfully tragic. But at the end of the story, in theory, he's got some power. He's going off to do some exploring. This is going to be great. And you realize he's going in the wrong direction. But then there was some of the technology, but the technology that powered the star in A Deepness in the Sky, I think had to be beyond or even transcend level technology, right? So there was a kind of an interaction there. And it also has one of those great opening lines, you know, the manhunt. I can't remember. The manhunt took so many centuries and so many light years and so on. I mean, it's a...
And rumors, and they said he was dead, and they said that he was... coming back with a fleet on. It's such a great opening.
And that's one of the things that I really appreciate about Vinge, is that he has those moments of literary prose greatness. I mean, Seth, when we talked earlier, I think I described him as a five-tool author, right? Mm-hmm. His everything, he is not absolutely stellar in any one category, but he's very, very good in everything. And that just makes his stories. If you like great prose, there's a lot of moments in Deepness in the Sky, especially in my opinion. If you really like complicated, intricate plotting, he's got that kind of stuff. If you like seeing characters develop, he's got that stuff. The only thing that in his novels, I think he doesn't do particularly well is like having one central character and really developing that one central character, but everything else, I just feel like he does
even
very,
for that
very
in,
well.
In Deepness, the Spire character Zerkaner, I think she's pretty well
Underhill?
Developed. Yeah, yes, that's right, Underhill. And I wonder if that name is a purposeful sly reference to The Hobbit.
I had the same thought.
Yeah, I wondered.
I would argue also that in Rainbow's End, which I raced through this weekend, being unable to check out, I wanted to reread Deepness and Fire, but did not have those in the library. But they did have Rainbow's End, so I read that this weekend. And I would argue that Robert Gu is the central character, although you do get POV from some other people. And Robert Gu... Senior has a tremendous amount of character development and self-reflection. You know, he's he's not a comfortable character. He is, in fact, a horrible person, at least at the beginning, who delights in taking other people down and making them feel bad. But he starts thinking more about not how to do this, but, you know, his relations to others. And he can be careless and thoughtless and selfish, but he can also, it turns out, make sacrifices. And so I think he has just a tremendous amount of growth in that book.
That book is so wonderful. And it actually inspired my wife and I to take a road trip down to the Geisel Library just to see it. And the imagery in that book, like, I love all of his novels, but the poetic nature of Rainbow's End, with the virtual reality depicting the Geisel walking around on concrete legs, and the maws of these shredding machines as the books are thrown in, like, it's just, it's evocative. And it just lands. It has such an impact.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that I think is an underrated novel. It, because of the series that they're embedded in, and perhaps because they're far future, there's a certain spectacle to them. Fire Upon the Deep and Deepness in the Sky remain, I think, at the forefront or near the forefront of SF conversation. But Rainbow's End, a Hugo winner and an outstanding novel, doesn't get the same notice. And I think probably it deserves it.
And it's set next year, in the year 2025.
Yeah, and one of the things that, having read the obituary that David Brin posted for Werner Vinge, that he had been suffering from Parkinson's, that makes me wonder how personal Rainbow's End was to him.
Yeah. Right. In Rainbow's, Robert Goose Sr. had Alzheimer's, but of course there are parallels. Seth, you had asked earlier about, you know, if someone hasn't read any Vinge, what to start with. And I might well recommend Rainbow's End rather than, you know, Deepness or Fire, just because it is very approachable. Well, an unlikable at the start main character, but it's set in a very near future that is very close to what we have now. You know, he missed some timeline stuff. Not everybody walks around with skins of, you know, visual skins of their favorite cartoon characters overlaying everything. You know, don't have
augmented reality.
Right. You know, the closest we have to that is probably the Pokemon virtual reality games, catching stuff on your phone, you know, but at least that is widespread. The polities are very close to what we have now. You don't have to struggle to figure out, you know, corporatocracies or vastly different political systems. And, you know, you have recognizable family structures. It's you have a bunch of people going back to school because they have now medicine has let them recover. And now they have to actually start new careers again instead of just resigning themselves to decay, mental, you know, stultification. But it's very it's action adventure-y. It's actually like a lot of near future thrillers, but to reflect that it was written in 2006, and as Rich was mentioning, the prose, the beautiful evocations of things, I think this might be my top recommendation for a new to Vinge start if you are a little intimidated by what you'd be wading into in Fire or Deepness.
Yeah, I mean, I understand that recommendation. Certainly something like A Deepness in the Sky is, it's an undertaking, but, you know, that was where I started, and I had a very good time with that. Rainbow's End was a little more, I had a harder time following that one. So it's one that I'd like to revisit at some point. When I did the podcast with Scott McNulty, I had to have him explain a couple things to me that I missed.
I've had Greg Egan explain things to me that I missed in one of his novels. But I think a lot of people might have that experience with Greg Egan, at least missing them. I, as a short fiction guy, you know, for many years, I first came to Vinji via his short fiction. I would suggest True Names is it's very approachable, and the ideas in it that were very new when he wrote it have become kind of familiar, not just in science fiction, but they're part of our general pop culture, thanks partly to William Gibson. But so that's one good place to start. But a story that I completely loved when I first read it was The Blabber, which is, you know, it's not precisely in the same future as Fire Upon the Deep and Deepness in the Sky, but it has some characters that show up in Fire Upon the Deep, and also later even in The Children of the Sky. And it has the basic concept of the zones has been set up, and it's a really powerful moving story, as I said before, about, you know, the agony of knowing there's this wonderful place that you simply are almost certainly not going to ever be able to get to. Still plenty of neat extrapolation. It's, you know, the only thing I regret about it is it comes to the end, and it's clearly the first part of what could have been a big story. And Vinji says something in his after remarks to that, to the effect that, you know, people think that authors know where everything's going, but that's not always the case. So I do plan to continue this, but maybe while he says something like, I'm still thinking, just give me time, I'm still thinking. And I think when he thought things through, he ended up with A Fire Upon the Deep, and by then realized that the idea he had about, oh, the backstory of the Tynes and what Ravna and Hamid and the Tynes were going to do in the future just didn't fit where he eventually wanted to go. So it was kind of discarded, and we never got to see that story. And I'd kind of like to see that, but sadly we never will.
Seth, on thoughts about where to start. He's got the collected short stories that is his short fiction, and it's got stories that are all antecedents or related to his three main storylines, to the Zones of Thought, to the Marooned real-time series, and then also Fast Times at Fairmont High, which is kind of a prequel to Rainbow's End. So I think that's a good place to start, because you can kind of get a picture of what he's about and what his writing is. As far as novels, if someone likes big, you know, likes Dune, sure, go for A Deepness. If they like more of the near future, Rainbow's End. Really, the only one of his novels that I would say probably like don't start or not really worth reading is his only standalone, is The Witling. It's fine. It's a 70s science fiction novel. I don't think it's remarkable in any way. And it really is surprising that this guy that had this later 20-year run came out with this book, in my opinion, because it's, you know, it's fine. But he's also like 30 when he writes.
Yeah, and it's, so, like I said earlier, I am rereading that now, because it's the one novel of his I hardly remembered, partly because it's the weakest of his novels. But it does some interesting stuff. He thinks through the real implications of teleportation in a way that almost no author does. You know, every other authors use teleportation don't take into account the idea that when you teleport from one place to another, let's say on a sphere, on a planet, you're going to be moving a lot faster or moving a lot slower if you're changing latitudes. I mean, things like that. And Vinci thought that through and made that part of his story, and made, you know, it is a novel that's got some thought behind it. It just isn't fully developed, and the plot is a little limper, and it's got some maybe somewhat annoying ideas about male-female interactions that he himself might have been ashamed of in later years, I think. But
I noticed nobody's brought up Tadja Grimm's world.
Yeah, and that's a good, very fun novel. It's better than The Witling, in my opinion. But it is early work, and that shows. But it's still a lot of fun. I mean, it strokes, it's a novel in a way about science fiction readers, and therefore it is stroking the egos of us in a way that some such novels do, right? The story of how it was written is a little bit unusual too. You know, he wrote a novella for Orbit, and you know, you think of Werner Vinge, hard science fiction analog writer. One of his major early stories was, well, The Apartness was in New Worlds, and then Grimm's World, the novella version, was in Orbit, the supposed New Wave bastion. But Vinge was that kind of writer who would appeal to Michael Moorcock and to Damon Knight as much as he appealed to John Campbell and Stan Smith. And so, but he wrote that novella, and he said, okay, I'll expand it in a novel, and he expanded it in a novel, and then Bain came back to him 20 years later and said, it's not long enough for the way novels are now. You need to add another section to it. So he wrote, the story that was published separately in Analog, but The Barbarian Princess. And it's a really neat story. And then they slapped it all together into a new edition of the novel. I would say it's worth reading. If you want something that's not as naughty as in some ways his later novels are, it's not a bad place to start in that it's a lot of fun. And it's where a lot of readers probably started with him, because if you were just reading novels back in the 60s, that was the only one you could get by Werner Vinge.
I would say the best one to start with is A Deepness in the Sky. I spent about 5 years forcing copies of this book on all of my friends and then nagging them until they read it. It's just so big and so interesting and so in depth, and it really is his masterwork. Like this is in my personal canon, this is one of the five great sci-fi novels. Like it's up there with Orwell. It's up there with Heinlein's Best. It's up there with The Dispossessed. It is a truly great novel. Rich, you actually knew him personally, did you?
Oh, no, I never met Vinge. By the time I was attending science fiction conventions, and the first WorldCon I bought a membership to was the Chicago WorldCon in 2000 that you mentioned, and an emergency came up at work, and I could not get away, and I didn't end up going to a WorldCon until the next Chicago WorldCon. I'm originally from Chicago, so that's convenient for me, but... I very often wish I'd gotten more heavily into fandom and conventions and so on earlier than I did. So I never met Werner Vinge. By all accounts, he was a prince of a man and an extremely interesting person to talk to, but I never had the opportunity. And as I said in my obituary, even so, the way his thought came through in his novels made them seem like a conversation he was having with his readership in some ways.
And it's funny. I attended that WorldCon, and I only saw him at a distance one time, and that was the only time I saw him. Hmm. But my father crossed paths with him a few times because they were both involved in the IEEE, acronym, Institute of Electrical and Electronics Engineers.
Yes.
And of course, Vinge wrote quite a number of things for the IEEE, for their magazine Spectrum, as well as some of their lesser known titles.
Yeah.
I wish that this morning, maybe, I don't know, yeah, I guess it was this afternoon, maybe 20 minutes before we got on the call, I saw Mitch Wagner, who's been on the podcast a couple of times, had posted on Facebook some of his interactions with Werner Vinge, because Mitch had kind of parlayed his little bit of notoriety to get on some panels at cons, and so had been able to interact with him. It would have been fun to talk to Mitch.
I remember Mitch
about
from he was another guy that I knew back in the early Usenet days. I was thinking about reputation. As you point out, The Deepness in the Sky truly is one of the great SF novels, and it's a well respected book, but you don't maybe see it mentioned as often as it should be in the company of books like The Dispossessed that you mentioned. And when I was looking at him, I thought, here's a guy with 5 Hugo Awards and a distinguished career over decades and undeniable culture-wide influence. And I don't think I ever heard him mooted as a candidate for SFWA Grandmaster. And looking back on his career now, I'm saying he was a Grandmaster. You know, I don't want to kick anyone out of that that club. And you know, maybe the answer is there are so many outstanding writers that we can't get to everyone. But he was truly at that level, in my opinion.
Yeah, I was thinking about science fiction writers from 30 to 40 years ago that I, you know, would have been, their careers would have been finished when I started reading science fiction, and who I could think of, and just comparisons to Vinci to try to draw that out. And it's not science fiction, but the one comparison I kept coming back to is somebody like John Jay, who's one of the founding fathers of the U.S., super influential. And if you ask the average person who was John Jay, they're going to say, I don't know. But if you ask an average science fiction fan, probably in 15, 20 years, that who is Werner Vinge, they may say, I don't really know. But his contributions to the field and to like the singularity stuff that we didn't even really touch on, but a lot of the AI alignment figures that are currently out there say that Vinge's work was really influential on them thinking about AI alignment, and some of the AI researchers. Vint Cerf apparently was friends with Werner Vinge, sure, who's one of the, you know, founders of the, or creators of the internet. So I think that Vinge really is going to have a long lasting impact on not just science fiction, but on a lot of the topics that he touched on. And it may not be something that the average person really knows about or is aware of, just because he is more of that niche author. Now, if somebody could convince, you know, Netflix or Amazon to make a prestige TV show, 8-episode TV show about a deepness in the sky, that might change.
That's everything. An intriguing idea, because, you know, the funny thing about that is that would require, yeah, it could be done. You have to translate the spiders again, right, to be on TV, but you can translate them the same way. And then at the end, show reality with quotes. No, that would work.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I was watching the Marvel TV show WandaVision and thinking that's got some of the similar like cracks in reality ideas that if you were trying to do deepness as a TV show, you would have to do something, something kind of like that. This like slow reveal of this is not what it seems.
But you'd absolutely need a series, not a movie. Oh, please don't ever try to make a movie of this.
No. I do really admire that part of A Deepness in the Sky, because it starts off almost like the, you know, the Star Trek convention where aliens all speak English for some reason, and we just go, oh, it's the universal translator. And then when you get that reveal that, oh no, this is all because of the translation.
Rich, you commented on the fact that he was never a Sifu Grandmaster, and I'm just looking at the other 5-time Prose Hugo winners. Mm-hmm. So only counting, you know, novel, novella, short story, novelette, and series. Mm-hmm. There's actually only, I think, 12 of them. And it's Connie Willis, Fritz Lieber, Harlan Ellison, Joe Haldeman, Larry Niven, Lois McMaster-Bujold, Michael Swanwick, Mike Resnick, Paul Anderson, Roger Zelazny, Ursula K. Le Guin, and Werner Vinge. Mm-hmm. So if I recall correctly, he's the only one who won 5 Hugos without being named Grandmaster.
Don't think Resnick is.
Oh, really?
And Zelazny absolutely would have been, but he died rather young, in his early 60s, I think, if my memory's correct. And so he was a case, as with Philip Dick, of someone who was certainly on the, or Ted Sturgeon for that matter, who's certainly on the track to be a Grandmaster. But since it has to be given to a living writer, he didn't get it. And Resnick is dead now, too, of course. He would be the one writer of that list who, and I don't want to cause offense to anyone, but I don't consider him at the Grandmaster level the way I consider all the other writers you just mentioned, including, you know, Zelazny and, you know, even though, as I said, he isn't a Grandmaster, but only because he died too soon. Mm. And Vinci's case, I honestly think it's partly that his career was, well, he wasn't that prolific, so he wasn't constantly in the eye. Mm-hmm. And the early part of his career was good. It was sound. It was interesting. But you're not going to look at the author of The Witling or even The Peace War, which is a fine, fun novel. But you're not going to look and say, oh, clearly this guy's a grandmaster, right? But then after that, you start to see work that has really gone to another level. And I think sometimes people take a long time to adjust their perceptions in a case like that. In a case like Ursula Le Guin, to say, you know, one of my absolute favorite writers, you can read her, in my opinion, you can read her first story, a rather slight story called April in Paris. But you can read that and you look at it and you say, this is a writer. I mean, it's not that it's an all-time classic. It's that you can see in that story that she is already a remarkable writer. And it was, you know, it was only less than 10 years after that that she wrote The Left Hand of Darkness. So she got there much more quickly than Vinge, who was first story, a very fine story that was collected in Year's Best, was published in 65. But it wasn't until over 20, and maybe if you count True Names, a little under 20 years later, that he started to really make a mark. So I think that's part of the reason. It's hard to say.
Yeah, and as somebody who came to Vinge, 2002 was when I read Deepness in the Sky. I really wonder how the perception of him from people who had read all of this short fiction, and like you said, Peace War and Marooned in Real Time, which are good novels, but just, I feel like A Fire Upon the Deep, people probably picked that up and read that and said, wow, this came from Werner Vinge? Like, I just feel like he really has that transitional stage from analog to digital. He was a fine analog type. Not the magazine, but, you know, just more that idea. And then gets into digital and computational and just really hits his stride. And his output from about 85 until 2007 is just remarkable.
Returning to early Vinge stories, we talked a little bit about Apartness and how everybody thinks about that story based on the criticism of apartheid, which is really important to why it became so well-liked as a story. It's interesting to me that was actually not why he wrote the story, because he was thinking about there were indigenous people on every continent except for Antarctica. Mm-hmm. And why were there, it is no less hospitable a place than, of course, the Arctic, but right. Antarctica didn't. And so he created a story where in the distant future, there were now indigenous people there.
And then he hung a very ironic depiction of the apartness that the apartheid regime wanted, which is, you know, and that's a key to almost any great science fiction story, is that you have a great idea, but then you connect that idea not just to the idea itself, cool as it may be. And there are many stories that do little but expand on a great idea, and they can be pretty worthwhile. But when you connect that to a real human character or political or fundamentally a human idea, if you will, that's what elevates the best science fiction.
There's almost a Rod Sterling quality to that, Rod Serling quality to that story. Just the way it uses the science fictional idea to make a political point. And I mean, that last line, that let them have their apartness, just, it's so memorable. You know what, if we're talking great places to start with Vinge, I'd say Apartness is not a bad place to start.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. If you look through the rest of his stories in that, say, the first decade of his career, every one of them, I would say, is worth reading, though they're not, none of them are going to knock you flat. Although Bookworm Run is quite a good story. It's a story that for a story written first version, I assume he revised it as a senior in high school. That's it's a pretty impressive piece of work. You know, those stories are all worth reading. They're not the stories that are going to make you love him for the rest of your life, but they're stories that are worth the time. He also wrote one story, a pretty good story, in collaboration with his wife Joan, The Peddler's Apprentice.
Well, I think we've kind of arrived at a little bit of a lull here, and definitely provided some good places to start. You know, depending on your level of understanding or familiarity with Finji. You know, one of the big ideas, I think we had at least three or four recommendations of where to start. So that kind of gives you an idea that if you're not familiar with them, then there are a lot of good options and you can't really go wrong. Certainly, you know, I definitely enjoyed everything that I read. Rainbow's End was more of a challenge for me, but certainly the Zones of Thought is just something that it's one of those things that, throughout reading all the Hugos, that concept of the Zones of Thought has really stuck in my head. And that's, you know, the kind of thing that a master storyteller can do, come up with those concepts and then put a good story on them. So maybe we should just sort of go through final thoughts. Olav, I think you wanted to say something.
Yeah, you know, Vinci's great novels often started out as short stories that he expanded on. And so when his last fully developed short story with character and narrative came out, it was Preliminary Observations on the Drake Equation, being an excerpt of the logs of Star Captain Y.T. Lee, which is a heck of a name to actually try and memorize. I've probably muddled it, the name somehow. But it came out in the Tribute to Frederick Pohl anthology. And it's this really great little story, and I love it. And I think it's often forgotten about when talking about his oeuvre, because it came out after the collection of his stories that people pick up and talk about. And I always sort of hoped that we would get a full novel based on that premise. I thought it was a really nice premise. I thought it had some really cool ideas to it. And the satire of academia and was just really, really well done.
Final thoughts, Russ?
Anywhere you start with Vinge is with Werner Vinge is just great. Him and Alistair Reynolds are my top two authors. They're very different, but anywhere you start with him, it is going to be a great read. He really does think through all of his stories to the logical conclusion and the implications of whatever science fictional idea he's putting in there. He deeply thinks through it. He's a solid writer, solid plot master, solid character development. I'm really grateful that we got the stories that we got from him and that he didn't, you know, decide in the 70s, I'm done writing, but he kept going and we got more of his later work.
Nice. Nice. How about you, Trish?
Echoing all that, I guess I'll just add that, you know, I'll stick with my Rainbow's End as an easy, soft intro for Vinji. But if you know that your reading time is limited and you are only going to read one book by Werner Vinge, in that case, I would switch over to Olav's side and say, just one Vinge book, make it Deepness in the Sky.
One thing I did want to say, what Olav said with regard to the story in the Pohl anthology, that it would have been so nice to have a novel based on that. I think he had one or two more potential Zones of Thought novels in his head. He probably had ideas we don't know about. And with any writer whose career is cut short by an illness, that's something to really regret. That he was a great writer, a great science fiction writer, and I wish we had more. So it is with so many writers, but it even more so when a writer does get ill before the end. And to mention Alistair Reynolds, an interesting point. A friend of mine just posted just an hour or two before calling in here randomly. Hey, I just read this great Alistair Reynolds novel, and the first author he compared it to was Werner Vinge.
Just Russ said something interesting, and I'd like to just add to that, that so many of the icons in sci-fi and fantasy, their work declined in their later career. I mean, nobody's going to say that Heinlein's best novels were his later ones. And I think it's really interesting that, you know, Vinge is somebody who's, as Rich pointed out earlier, really improved over time. And his two novels that have been recommended repeatedly here, Rainbow's End and Deepness in the Sky, are two of his last three novels. Like, he is a writer whose craft got better. And you look at the oldest Hugo winners ever, and he won for Rainbow's End at the age of almost, he was almost 63 when he won that Hugo, making him the third oldest person to win the Hugo for best novel. You know, this is kind of remarkable to me and worth celebrating.
Yes. And his last novel, Children of the Sky, which we haven't really mentioned, and it doesn't quite stand with his very best novels, but still a very good novel. And, you know, no one can hit a grand slam every time. He hit a ringing double with that novel, let's just say. And there's no indication that he was declining as he hit his 70s. It was just a tragic illness, I think.
I will say I'm 100% here for the baseball science fiction analogies, by the way.
Children of the Sky is just so underrated. I know people who have only read Vinge's Zones of Thought novels, and they think, oh, I don't really care about that one. I only got partway into it and then abandoned it. And I just think you're missing out if you don't finish off all three of them.
I haven't read that one yet. I literally put a hold request on it while we were talking from my library. before we actually sign off, folks, I know that, like, Olav, do you want to promote anything or mention your blog? I know people know you if they've, you know, listened to this podcast.
My wife and I have a blog called Unofficial Hugo Book Club Blog. It's at hugoclub.blogspot.ca. I still dislike the name. It's just been there for 5 years and I can't change it.
Yes, but excellent site. So, and is anybody else have anything they want to talk about? Rich, I know you mentioned your site earlier, but maybe you want to repeat it now.
My blog is called Strange Ekpatan, which is an obscure reference to a great poem by Alistair MacLeish, Archibald MacLeish. Terrible of me. But it's a beautiful poem. You should read it. It's not science fiction. But in that, there I discuss pretty much everything I've been reading, which is a lot of science fiction, a lot of old science fiction, a lot of old non-science fiction, like Victorian novels are a particular fondness of mine, and that sort of thing. And also Blackgate, which is John O'Neill's site, just www.blackgate.com, where a variety of us write a whole lot for John. I publish something there every month or so, maybe even a little more often sometimes. And so that's where you can find my stuff now.
Oh, sir, I just really liked your review of the Linda Nagata book recently.
Oh, thank you. Yeah.
Trish or Russ?
I blog occasionally at whatsthewordnow.blogspot.com. I'm on Twitter at Blue Sky. I'm on Masto at, let's see, newsy.social at Trish EM. And you can also find me pretty often at Skiffy and Fanny.
Sounds good. Russ, anything to promote?
I just yell at people over email a lot. So if you get emails from me, I just like to email. I don't really do social media or stuff like that.
All right. Feel free to lob one at me anytime you want.
I will.
All right. Well, thank you, everybody, for doing this, especially on such short notice. And Olav, thank you for the idea and the shove in the right direction, because I think this was a good thing to do.
Yeah, thanks. And thanks, Olav, for recommending me, and thanks for inviting me, Seth. So,
all right. Thank you, Joel.
Thanks.
Bye.